Session number 13265, wheel number 35.
Mr. Marsden, reel 35.
I remember they walked around the station always together. They were inseparable. Heads together, and I suppose talking over preparations for the next show or some theatrical thing or other. And one day they were both LACs. And the next day, quite suddenly, they were both sergeants. Bing, which is jumping the intervening rank of corporal, you see. They'd been made sergeants as part of the new EVT program. In the services at this time, the educational vocational training program was established, under which all kinds of chaps in the service of whatever rank who had skills which they could pass on to other folk who were going to be demobilised and which would be of use to them in peacetime in Civvy Street were made up as sergeants if they didn't already hold that rank or something higher. And they became EVT instructors. And It really became a jobs for the boys effort, a soft number, and there were people applying for EVT instruction in all sorts of things. One chap went regularly down to London to get ballet training, for instance, and his training fees were paid, and he got travel warrants and everything else. All sorts of the weirdest subjects were being covered under this program. And I had no part of it. There was, as far as I could see, there was nothing worthwhile on station that was going to do me any good. So I just, in case I was busy enough looking after the section. At this time I had in the gaseous equipment section, in addition to all the aircrew types who'd been lumbered onto us simply to accommodate them, ex-aircrew people, I had also a load of Barbadians and Jamaicans, and I think some of them had nominal flight mechanic training, some of them had no engineering training at all, but here again all the sections had these chaps for whom no real purpose could be found at this stage of the game. There was one advantage to it. Our section, I discovered that we had the best cricket team on the station. The Barbadians had a number of very good cricket players amongst them, and there were one or two of the Jamaicans. One of the Jamaicans, a most objectionable little chap, young, he was an absolutely wizard bowler. He was not a dead loss in every other way. I used to chase his backside left, right and centre. He was late on parade, he was scruffy, there was always a lot of back chat. If there was any work to be done, he was gone. The perisher stood up to me one day and he said, "Corporal," he says, "you don't like black people, do you?" He says, "you don't like me." I said, "You're too right, I don't like you." I said, "but by the same token, I don't like him either, and he's white." I said, "but you're a bigger scrounger than he is." I said, "I do like him, and him, and him, and them. They're black." I said, "don't come to me with this, you don't like me because I'm black." I said, "I don't like you because you're you." I said, "I don't like you because you're a skiving, lazy, low-life son of a so-and-so." I said, "you're a pain in the neck. You don't get onto parade at the right time, as we all have to parade because that's the way it is." But if we didn't have to parade, I wouldn't go either. I said, "but you don't get on the parade in time." I said, "you're always late, you're always scruffy, you don't turn out well, you give a lot of backlit, you don't do any work, you always duck it. I said, what's the like about you? I said, go away and think about it. And a couple of the Barbadians there, there were one or two chaps who were older than I was. They fell about laughing. They thought this was just a ticket. Time somebody spoke to him like that. And, well, I took a poor view of being accused of picking on the fella because he had a black skin. What's the colour of his skin got to do with it? You know?
I've heard that in some forces' camps in the last part of the war and after the war, there were race riots. Did you ever hear of anything like that?
Not quite, but there was a riot in the dining hall at Henlow one day, and I got to the point by the end of the war where I was getting utterly sick and fed up with the smell in the dining halls. The dining and Henlow dining room, of course, was very old. Henlow is a first war station, old building, and the building was utterly ingrained with old cooking and stale cooking smells and so on, and it had got to the point where I could manage it for breakfast, I could manage it for the midday meal, and I couldn't, well, I think of it now, it turns me up, I couldn't face it for the 5 o'clock evening meal. And I'd got into the habit of going up the road, there was a little cafe somewhere near Henlow Station, just up the road, and I used to go up there. I spent sixpence or a shilling or so and have an evening snack. As I say, I just couldn't face the evening meal. Well, I gather that one day a whole gaggle of the Jamaicans went in there, and they were served up food. I never did find out whether it was the attitude of the cooks to the Jamaican chaps or the food itself, but I heard that pretty well all the plates of food ended up either stuck to the ceiling or stuck to the walls, and that was a fair old kerfuffle went on in there. But it was, as far as I knew, it didn't concern any of the people for whom I was responsible. Never, there was nothing ever came back to me, at any rate. I don't recall any of them going missing. And so that's really all I knew about it at the time. And I didn't concern myself. It, you know, what wasn't your problem wasn't your problem. You stood off. That's about as near as I ever got to anything of that order.
But that was the Jamaicans rather than the Barbadians.
Oh, yes, I doubt the Barbadians would behave like that. The Barbadians were noticeably and obviously adults, whereas the Jamaicans tended to be a bit childish. I'm speaking in four-inch brush terms here, but that was the difference in general character and general behaviour. That's not to say that there weren't adult Jamaicans, and it's not to say that there weren't Barbadians who might have been a bit on the silly side either, but take them in the lump, block for block, there was that obvious difference, and I gather from other folk I spoke to that other folk felt the same way about the people from the West Indies. The Barbadians were distinctly different people. Probably, and looking at them and thinking about it too, I would guess they were tribally different, possibly from a different part of Africa even. But they were socially... That's it, that's the only way to call it. They were different people.
In, I think it was June 1945, the Labour Party had a great landslide in the election. Why do you think, and it's often said that it was the returning forces who put them in, have you any comments on that?
Well, I think possibly that since Churchill had been seen to be a manager, as it were, chief manager, prime minister during the war, and that therefore one tended to associate, despite the government, it was supposed
coalition.
To be supposed to be coalition. Nevertheless, one tended to associate conservatism with Churchill, and also there was the tendency to remember pre-war conditions as well, largely under conservative governments, and probably because of the almost overwhelming tendency of the other ranks in the forces to buy the Daily Mirror rather than any other newspaper, I imagine that there was a genuine wholesale swing towards the Labour Party on the part of the majority of the other ranks in the forces. I suppose Jane would have a lot to do with that. People buy the Daily Mirror to see Jane and really foul and so on, and end up seeing the headlines on the front page when they get round to that, and taking note of the Daily Mirror point of view. There was quite a real belief that mistakes had been made during the war, major mistakes had been made, and that the majority of the mistakes that were made by the kind of people who would be conservatives, whether these were top brass or politicians. And that would all play its part. But there was, of course, a fairly solid working class resentment of conservatism from all the years before the war, when times had been hard. See, all of us were young enough to feel that, and just old enough to remember it. Folk of my age, I was 26 when I came out of the service. In 1945, I was 24, but I could remember, as I may have said already, I could remember the detritus of the First War, sculling around Chesterfield on trolleys made out of old prams, men with arms missing and legs missing and so on, and rows of medals, coughing and spitting from gas, and begging, trying to play an instrument, some sort or other, a battered trumpet, to get a few pennies together. And from speaking to our uncles and relatives, so that we were aware of how the servicemen had been treated, or not treated at all, just ignored after the First War. Far from it being a It was a country fit for heroes to live in. Like, it was a country you needed to be a hero to live in. There was the general feeling that we didn't want this kind of thing to happen to us when we came out, and that under the old dispensation, which would be conservatism, that might be very likely what you would get. So there was I suppose there was that inherent fear of that kind of situation reoccurring. And of course it's simply, as we've said, an awful lot of us were young, and the young think with their bellies. They don't really think what you get are emotional reactions to situations. And I think we reacted.
Did you vote Labour yourself?
Oh yes, yes. I think it's the only time in my life I did.
What did you feel about the performance of the Labour government of 45?
I don't know if I took much note. I thought I couldn't understand at first. It took a while to be able to realise how it was that we were worse off in peacetime than we had been in wartime. You know, rationing got harder rather than better. Remember, bread rationing didn't start until either very late in the war or after the war, for for instance. So that kind of thing. And clothes rationing continued. But, you know, as regards housing, that didn't worry me. We'd saved enough, as I said, we'd saved money. I was able to put £600 down towards a house as a result of our savings and, as it were, pre-death bequests, because an uncle of mine gave us £100. As he said, you can have it when I die or you can have it now, and it makes more sense now. So he gave me £100 towards buying the house, and my mother gave me £100, as she said, well, if your dad had been alive and so on, or if things had been, when your dad was killed, she said, some of the money that I got as compensation was really for you, so here it is. So, what with that, and as I say, the money we'd scratched together, we were able to put down £600 against a house we bought costing £1,100. And Margaret's father paid all the solicitor's fees. That was his wedding present to us. So that we did rather well. And so housing was no problem. And because I'd had the forethought to get into the emergency training scheme as well, then there was no problem, as far as I was concerned, with finding a job. There were plenty of jobs for men teachers.
Some people attribute the forces left-wing voting in 1945 to the influence of the Army Bureau of Current Affairs, but I think that you said you'd never heard of that. In any case, you were in the RAF, so it wasn't the Army. But.
No, I hadn't. Wasn't a thing that concerned us at all. In fact, in many ways, I was already becoming my own man. I was beginning to walk down my own track, and I was beginning to go the way I was going to go. I was beginning to develop my own ideas already about things. I was doing my own separate reading. I was already convinced, even at this game, at this early in the game, that politics, as we saw it, was, whilst it was concerned with necessary things, it was taking no note whatever of all the things that it should have been doing. The maintenance of renewable fuel supplies, of the using up non-replaceable resources and so on. I was becoming very aware of that kind of thing. And so a lot of the ordinary chit-chat of the political flannel in the newspapers and so on, I let it go straight past me.
What was your attitude towards Churchill as a war leader during the war? Did it remain the same throughout the war?
Yes, I think so. I was already aware from my own reading that one of the things for which Churchill was denigrated most, the Gallipoli business, was not such a bad thing after all, and that the mishandling of Gallipoli was quite as much the fault of the admiral in charge at the beginning of the landings and whatnot as it was of Churchill's basic planning. If they'd got stuck straight in and gone ashore immediately and done the job as they were supposed to do, the whole Gallipoli story would have been quite different. So I didn't take the line that he was a crackpot. The thing that aroused so much criticism of Churchill, I think, amongst the people who were in big enough positions to be able to make their criticisms count or to get them published, was that he was a lateral thinker. Churchill was quite open to looking at every possible way of tackling the enemy and trying everything that might be worth trying. For instance, Habakkuk, and the ice crete and that kind of thing sounds totally crackpot, but was in fact eminently sensible and well worth tackling. But of course the hardened artery army type, brass, the Hague School of Warfare, chuck men in because you've got more men than they have, you're bound to end up with some in hand at the end when all theirs are gone. Churchill simply couldn't cope with that. He didn't want any more of it. I'm not entirely aware of this in 1945, for instance, but I rapidly become aware of it as I carry on with my reading.
Did you listen to Churchill's wartime broadcast, like The Few and Blood, Sweat and Tears and that kind of thing?
Given the opportunity, yes. Yeah, and I've no doubt at all we found them intensely moving and entirely relevant. Yes, the blood, sweat and tears thing. Yeah. Yes.
Did you ever listen to Lord Haw Haw?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, we used to fall about. So we thought it was highly, very amusing.
But did he ever say things which proved to be right, which shook you?
Not that I can recall. A great many of the things I think that he broadcast were very like the kind of things that spiritualists put over in seances and fortune tellers doings. A lot of it, I think, was psychological conmanship. Although I have to say that I attended a spiritualist meeting in 1940, and the medium picked me out and said there was a soldier standing behind me, and he said I was to carry a blue ribbon, and I would be all right. Well, I don't know if the blue ribbon was intended to be the blue ribbon of teetotalism, but I carried a scrap of blue ribbon in my purse throughout the whole war, and I had more lives than you can shake a stick at in near misses, you know, bombs landing within a few yards and the incident with the wildebeest and things like that. So you could say I was sucker enough to fall for it, but I was under no great illusions about that kind of thing. One of the things I remember about Henlow is looking, going on parade at 7:30 in the morning, and looking to the east and seeing B-17s taking off from American Air Force stations in the immediate neighbourhood. Well, the immediate neighbourhood to within 10 or 15 miles east of us. And I guess from about 6:30 or 7 o'clock these forts would have been taking off and climbing in quite gentle spirals and forming up into squadrons and then into wings, and spiralling the whole time, climbing quite gently until they'd made something of the order of 15,000 feet before they set off, forming up into wings, before they set off eastwards off for Germany or wherever their targets were. Quite large numbers of them. And it would be, well, starting at 7 o'clock in the morning, some of the poor perishers would have been in the air for 3 hours before they actually started going anywhere, because quite commonly it was gone 9:30, 10 o'clock, before the wings were formed up and they were actually heading off on the operational flights. And on a number of occasions, whilst that was happening, we saw aircraft collide in mid-air. And sometimes there'd be an explosion and the whole shooting match would go, and sometimes you'd just see the broken bits come twinkling down in the sky. And those chaps must have been pretty halfway tired before they actually got over the North Sea, because by the time they got over the North Sea, they'd have been in the air between 2.5 and 3.5 hours sometimes. Seemed to us a terrible way to run the show. And instead of actually climbing all the way up, presumably they had to get this much height before they set off in order to give themselves time to climb to operational height before they got over Germany, I guess. Because the forts were really there, I believe that sometimes their the ammunition load they carried was greater than the bomb load. It seemed to us that the bomb load that the fortresses carried really was hardly worth carrying at all. About 3,000 pounds, 4,000 pounds of bombs for quite a long time. It was quite late in the war before they carried more than that. The mosquitoes carried more. But of course, what they were doing was fighting a war of attrition with the German fighters, with the Luftwaffe. It was their purpose, it seems to me, was largely to get the Luftwaffe into the air so that they could be drawn into battle in order that the German war effort could be diverted into fighter aircraft. And probably that was an operational aim of at least equal consequence to what they hoped to do with the bombs. Because, of course, the RAF aircraft were carrying very much greater bomb loads than the forts. Halifaxes by this time were carrying 9,000 and 10,000, 11,000 pounds of bombs by comparison with the forts, 3 or 4, and the Liberators for that matter too. Yeah.